This Week in Law is up next. We've got Lauren Gelman, Larry Downs, and Evan Brown joining me today. We're going to talk about what CNN and Fox didn't decide to do, the blurry edges of Project Glass, the latest threat to a useful net, and much, much more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown, episode 168, recorded June 29, 2012. Thoughts in the brain. Enhance your workflow, send files of almost any size easily and securely with ShareFile by Citrix. Try ShareFile today. For a 30-day free trial, go to ShareFile.com, click the radio microphone, and enter the promo code TWIL. Hey folks, it's Denise Howell here, and thank you so much for joining us for This Week in Law, your place for considering all things related to internet and technology, law, and policy. We've got an amazing panel of folks today to talk about all of those issues. Joining us once again from Forbes and CNET and all over the internet, Larry Downs. Great to have you back, Larry.
Great. Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Also joining us from Blurry Edge Strategies and Stanford Law School is Lauren Gelman. Hello, Lauren.
Hey, Denise. Thanks for having me.
Great to see you again. And joining us once again from Hinshaw and Culbertson and InternetCases.com in Chicago, Illinois, is Evan Brown. Hello, Evan.
Hey, Denise. Happy Friday to you. It's great to be here.
Great to see you. Okay, so the first episode of The Newsroom aired last Sunday. I watched it. I enjoyed it very much, and I'm looking forward to the next installment this Sunday. But it appears that perhaps the people at CNN and Fox weren't paying too close of attention to the theme of that show, which is getting things right in the news industry. And I believe the pilot show or the first show was called We Just Decided To. And I think someone at CNN and Fox just decided not to. And of course, what I'm talking about is the decision on healthcare that came down from the U.S. Supreme Court. And those two networks running both online and on their live television programming with the story, the breaking news headline that, in fact, the administration's healthcare proposal had been found unconstitutional by the Supreme Court and was not going to be going into effect. Fox has not apologized for this at all. What Fox is saying is, well, we were reading through the opinion as we were reporting, and at first blush, it looked like, from the language of the opinion, that that's what had happened. But then as we kept reading, we realized that's not what happened at all, and we reported that as soon as we realized it. Larry, you're probably the closest thing we have on the panel today to an ink-stained wretch in the journalism industry. You're more of a digital ink-stained wretch. Can you imagine a time and a circumstance where folks reporting on a Supreme Court decision would just come right out and say what the crux of the decision was without reading through the whole opinion? Is this just what we have to look forward to these days?
Yeah, I think it's unfortunately the case. And, you know, the problem here is you can't report on a Supreme Court decision. And even this one is relatively short at 100-some pages. But you have to read it first. And indeed, the problem they had was that the beginning of the majority opinion started with the dismissal of one argument. But then they went on to say, but we do accept this tax-based argument. So if you read the first couple of pages, it said, yeah, we don't like one of the government's arguments. We're rejecting that. But we are going to accept another one. And the problem here is, you know, Supreme Court decisions shouldn't be reported at all as if they're breaking news. They're not, you know, going to change your life in the next 5 minutes. In fact, you know, the individual mandate, I think, doesn't still a few years away before it would even go into effect, if it does go into effect. So they had obviously built up this whole thing that, oh, you know, when the decision comes, it's going to be important news. You have to know it right away. And the truth is, you don't have to know it right away.
Right. We do our best to give you the digest of law here on This Week in Law to look at things that have happened and try and become informed about them before we go ahead and tell you about them. Every now and then we'll have something happen live or real time during the show that will, you know, tell you about as much as we know about it at the time. But really, you know, we're more in the vein of trying to help you understand what's going on there. And I think, you know, as you point out, Larry, that anyone reporting on complicated judicial decisions probably should take that tack rather than the breaking news angle. Evan, what I found fascinating is you sent us a story from CNN about a, let's see, was he a congressperson?
He's Murdoch a candidate for Senate. His name.
He's a candidate for Senate who had prepared various YouTube responses to the decision, you know, four or five options of things he was going to post on YouTube, depending on what the Supreme Court decision was. Somehow they got out. And it was CNN who called him 3 days before they made their own blunder to the mat on that. So even though they're reporting on other people's mistakes, apparently it's just not really sinking in. What did you think about that?
This is the story of Richard Murdoch, who is a candidate for Senate in Indiana, who, incidentally, he's obviously enjoyed some success already because he defeated incumbent Richard Lugar in the primary for one of the Senate seats in Indiana. And Richard Lugar has been a senator for just about as long as I've been alive, literally. I think he's been a senator for Indiana since the 70s. So this guy, Richard Murdoch, is already standing on a pretty good platform for his run in the general election later this year. So his activities foreshadowed a bit what happened to the mainstream media here in his use of social media with this. He released several versions. And when I say he, it actually turns out it was obviously someone in his campaign. The article described it as a vendor, you know, it's like an independent contractor that the campaign had hired to manage the social media, the YouTube account. So I gather this is pretty customary for politicians to go ahead and have prepared statements ready, three or four different versions to handle whatever contingency actually arises, whatever actually happens. So what was going on here was, I think, a little bit different dynamic than the mistake that CNN and Fox made, because this was clearly not an agent participating in mainstream media, but someone using social media, certainly a social media account that gets a lot of attention. So there could be a little bit of hypocrisy on the part of CNN, or I guess it would be previous hypocrisy, because CNN was calling him out on this before CNN made its own error on this. But it underscores, I think, the larger question and the larger issue that, at least that I find interesting in all this, is there's this huge rush to be the first to report on something. And Larry very accurately observed that the Supreme Court's decisions are not something that should, by their nature, constitute breaking news. It has nothing to do inherently with what has happened with the Supreme Court, because process of that jurisprudence moves at a snail's pace, and the effect that it has. So clearly this is a kind of a meta phenomenon, an emergent property going on here. The media, and more importantly, and the new factor in all this is the social media effect of all this that accelerates the pace at which the news has to be broken, and thereby increases the pressure on the various outlets. Not only is it one participant in the mainstream media competing against another, CNN versus Fox, ABC, CBS, and all that stuff, but it's mainstream media and the participants therein and social media. There can be no discussion of the response and the things that happened after the Supreme Court's decision yesterday without mentioning the SCOTUS blog, which, you know, apparently had more traffic yesterday than all of its years combined.
That's a
social media. Yes, as a social media outlet. So all of these things go into increasing the pressure of all of this stuff. A little bit different than what Richard Murdoch did a week before. That seems to be more of a careless, less than perfect care being exercised in all of this. So different things going on, but certainly makes for plenty of material for Stephen Colbert to pick up on, like he did with the Richard Murdoch situation.
Yes, all of his lampooning of these folks has been quite fun. It seems to me that the SCOTUS blog is a good model for how you report real time, or as close to real time as you can, on Supreme Court developments, and maybe the more traditional media outlets should take a close look at how they do that. Lauren, at the conference we were at recently, the Tech Policy Summit, you were on a panel concerning the right to be forgotten. And I'm sure that these news outlets would love to be able to, you know, quickly pull back these wrong kind of tidbits that they occasionally throw out there in their urge to be speedy and timely. Do you think that the fast pace of social media is pushing us into these kinds of inaccuracies?
Oh, yeah. I think that part of the driver is, as I was saying on IRC, the news organizations want to be the first to tweet because then they get the retweets and then they get the click-throughs and that increases their viewership. And so the issue is not that the news is breaking. I think Jay Rosen, a professor at NYU, a journalism professor, has said, you know, no institution should be allowed to call something breaking news when it's accessible to everybody at the same time. It's not that it's breaking news. It's that by being the first to get it up on the website, you could be the first to tweet the link to the website, get the most hits to the website. And I think, you know, anybody who reads Supreme Court decisions or any kind of decisions, you know, understands that it's complex. And SCOTUS blog is doing a good job at trying to capture that complexity, but also provide, you know, be a player in the news culture, which is really a race to be first, even at the expense of getting it wrong, as we saw this week.
Evan, are there liability considerations that come into play here? Are outlets risking their own kinds of, not just the economic harm and ridicule that happens from getting something wrong, but actual, you know, folks that could come back and sue them over being inaccurate?
Seems pretty tenuous to me, doesn't it? You know, the closest thing that I could imagine, or the most plausible thing that I could imagine, or maybe I should say the least implausible thing that could happen here, is some kind of defamation or other dignitary harm that would occur from false reporting like this. But given the circumstances, usually I don't think that would even play out, because oftentimes the media would be reporting on a matter of public concern, probably about a public figure. And so that elevates the standard that must be met to prove defamation, you know, a showing of actual malice. And so given the rush and this pressure that we've been talking about, it seems like those factors would weigh pretty strongly against any facts put there to support a showing of actual malice. As far as negligence or something like that goes, again, it would be hard to show what kind of damage that would arise from something like this, which leads me into kind of another aspect of this. And I wrote a blog post about it yesterday on internetcases.com about this, is that, sure, there's this greater acceleration of pressure, a greater acceleration of speed, more pressure. But this is the comparisons to Dewey versus Truman are obvious. Yes, that takes about 2 seconds to figure that out. But Dewey versus Truman was in 1948, and the medium there was a newspaper. You know, thousands of literal sheets of paper had to be reprinted, and you know, had to notice the error, reset the typeface, reprint the reprint the paper, put it on trucks, and send it back out. So the point I'm making is, even though the there's this accelerating speed and increase in pressure to be the first, because of the ease with which information is distributed now, there's in the same proportion there is the ease by which mistakes can be corrected, errors made clear, retractions issued, and all of that stuff. So all of that goes to this original point of reducing the likelihood that there's actually going to be any harm over all this stuff. I'm a little put off by everybody being so mean to CNN and Fox and all this stuff. And maybe, you know, does Fox owe us an apology? You kind of suggested that maybe they do. I don't know. I mean, who even a smart constitutional scholar is not going to be able to you know, get an opinion, especially one as convoluted as the arrangement of parties and as kind of odd as this was with the way John Roberts was joining part of the opinion and all that stuff. When somebody needs to apologize, it's because they've really done something wrong. We're all human and we all do things wrong, but you know, I don't know. It's a question of just kind of ethereal kind of ethics of whether or not this was truly wrong. But the point being, is this really damaging to someone? And I say, it's just more fun to kind of talk about and do some ribbing against CNN and Fox rather than think that they've really let us down in any tremendous way.
Right. I think you're absolutely right. And it goes back to the debate that first started unfurling itself when people began to blog, you know, long before Twitter and Facebook and other sort of instantaneous short little soundbite bits of social media. There was this culture that developed in the blogging community that, hey, you know, we're a lot faster than traditional media, and we can get things out, and we may get things wrong, but people are going to correct us, and we will correct ourselves. And there is a great post over at the Citizen Media law blog about practical tips for avoiding liability associated with harms to reputation and the things that you should do. And I think CNN and Fox both did, you know, as soon as they realized they had blown this, they were correcting themselves and, as you said, mitigating any harm that might have occurred from people making a mistake. So I think it's a really kind of a blurry edge area, Lauren, where, you know, you want to be fast and you want to be able to correct yourself on the fly. But at the same time, when you have all this responsibility to inform the public, when you are CNN or Fox, maybe different standards should apply. What do you think about that?
Yeah, as you say, this is a long-running debate about the obligations of people who post things to the public. I guess I feel like CNN does, you know, it's not that they owe us an apology so much as that they owe people who are watching the obligation, to get it right. I mean, I think that it is very frustrating that they think it's so important to be first that they can't actually read the opinion before reporting on it. That should be just such an obvious prerequisite. And I think that I would want you or any blogger who's also, you know, reporting on the news to actually, you know, understand what's going on before they share it. So I think there's something to be said about live blogging and taking you through the process of understanding mm-hmm. something. And if that was what they were saying, if they were saying, you know, we are reading this now, here's what we are learning from the beginning. And, you know, if they were,
right.
But that's not what they were doing. They were trying to get to the end point first. And they can't do that without reading the opinion. There just has to be some line between journalism and water cooler conversation, or else just say that it's a work in progress. But that's not what they did, and I think they were definitely wrong here, and I think the criticism was earned.
Yes, I agree, and I think this kind of all goes to something you were talking about on your panel. One of the sound bites that really stuck with me from that conference was when you talked about the fact that the students that you teach at Stanford are nervous about this kind of thing, about putting things out in social media that might be whether embarrassing or incorrect or otherwise come back and haunt them reputationally. And so they don't engage. Do you obviously CNN and Fox don't have any choice. They can hopefully modify their behavior to be more careful and more transparent if they are, in fact, reporting in real time and still struggling to understand while they report something. But do you think that overall the internet has the potential to, you know, much as we think of it as this wonderful outlet for speech, to also chill speech as well?
Yeah, one of the examples I brought up when we were talking about the right to be forgotten was when I was teaching at Stanford Law School and I wanted my students to blog and they were reluctant to do so under their real names because they didn't want their opinions on these issues to come back and haunt them. And especially with my teaching privacy issues and their nervousness about their Supreme Court nomination hearings, you know, 30 years from now, I agreed with them in some sense that it's a legitimate concern. I think it's great everybody gets to speak, and but I do think the fact that you have a little less ability to form your own opinions in private does mean that you're tied to that as you go forward. And here, in the same way, you know, CNN is going to be defined by what happened in the reporting of this Supreme Court story. And I bet as a result, they're going to be a lot more careful next time they report something. You know, and that caution is good. That historical record, I think, is going to prove to be good for news in general. But that same caution applied to young people who are testing out opinions or reading new books or doing all the web browsing and social media that is happening now. I think there's some reasons to be concerned about how that's going to influence their future.
Now, Larry, you're obviously writing profusely on the web all the time, and sometimes I'm sure that you have opportunities to pause or correct or want to go back and amend something. Of course, you just go and do that, right? I mean, that's just your approach.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly don't want to change history and suggest that I didn't say something I said. Mm-hmm. Obviously, if I've written something and there's a change in the, you know, the story changes or I get new information, or I often do make mistakes, technical mistakes where I think I've understood the technical reality of something and I get it wrong, I'll go back and correct it. And I'll always note, as a good journalist would, that this is a correction rather than just sort of rewriting the text and pretending it hadn't been wrong in the first place. But, right. You know, I wish I shared Lauren's optimism about the result of this gaffe on the part of the news networks. I actually don't think they'll learn anything from it. I think most people will quickly forget that they made this mistake, and I think that the outlets will quickly forget that they made this mistake. I don't think they'll be particularly more careful in the future. Maybe in the next week or two. That seems to be how long these things last as a memory. But after that, you know, they're going to go back to. And I think Lauren was right. The point of the error in the first place wasn't that they were so eager to fulfill their duty to inform the public. I think the point was they wanted to be first. They wanted to be first for business reasons, to get the click-throughs, to improve their ratings. That's what it was really about, more than making sure that the public knew as soon as possible something that really has no effect on their day-to-day life now or in the immediate future.
Yep, I agree. And I think actually when all of this was unfolding, I actually thought this was the bigger story than the outcome of the Supreme Court decision that, you know, yes, the Supreme Court is going to rule one way or the other, but you hopefully trust the Fourth Estate to inform people as to what that ruling was and not, you know, mislead them. And I totally agree with you that I don't think others think that was the big story, you know, that this will get swept under the rug and people will just go on their merry way and continue to trust these outlets when, I think they have some learning to do in how to be fast and yet accurate. So I wish them well with that. I hope that it does have some kind of impact. Let's move on to something also related to this whole right to be forgotten and participation issue that we touched on. And that is over on Forbes, our friend Cash Hill reported on it's been going on at LinkedIn for a while, but as these things kind of take hold and people notice what's going on, it may take some time to pay attention to them. And I think that's what's happening here. LinkedIn has been not following the Facebook model of putting your face in ads to other people, but instead putting your face in ads to yourself in the context of, oh, there's an employer who is looking for someone just like you. And here, you know, picture yourself with this job title. And who knows, you know, maybe that's a good fit for you. So LinkedIn is being contacted by its institutional members and by recruiters working on their behalf to be able to advertise to potential candidates this way. So I don't know the right to publicity kind of claims such as were asserted against Facebook take on a bit of a new spin when you're being advertised to with your own image to yourself. It is interesting that, as Cash Hill put it, narcissism in advertising seems to be a new thing. But I could see where, you know, it would be an effective way to get people picturing themselves at a new job. And also, Cash had this really interesting earlier piece that she linked to when reporting this about the way that LinkedIn works and how it really behooves you to build out your network there. You don't necessarily have to participate, but if you want to benefit from the, you know, folks trying to find you new positions or offer you new positions, then the more people you're connected to and the, you know, smarter and better connected people you're connected to, the better, because that's how job offers are going to flow your way. There are algorithms that the network uses and markets to employers to be able to find people through referrals, et cetera. So I think this goes back, Lauren, to what we were talking about. If you're reticent to engage online, as more and more of this stuff related to the social graph gets automated, you're going to miss out on this kind of thing. Are you nervous for your students in this regard?
Well, first of all, I'm not nervous for my students because I think as a general matter, people are sharing a lot of information. So, when it comes to that, I don't know what to say about the LinkedIn thing. I think that this is a little bit, you know, the privacy issue is really that when your information is shared with companies that are looking to hire you or, and you don't know about that. So the advertisement just becomes sort of what's been called visceral notice, or it sort of tells you that this kind of sharing is happening, whereas usually it's just happening sort of behind the scenes and you don't know why you're getting suggestions for different contacts. So I think that as more people participate in different social media and more of these different kinds of tools are employed to engage with people, it actually provides more notice to them of the sharing that's going on behind the scenes in order to enable these notices. And so that actually in some ways has a positive influence on privacy. I think if I saw, you know, Lauren Gelman, you know, privacy attorney at Google or something pop up in me, I would find that a little weird. I don't know if, you know, I would be disturbed by it. So it would be interesting to see how other people react on it. I think I saw in Kashmir's piece that she suggested it's a good advertising technique because it actually opens the door to you thinking about yourself differently by seeing your name attached to one of these companies where you might not have before. And so to me, it's kind of an interesting new personalized advertising. But I think the more advertising is personalized, the more people are going to understand the sharing that facilitates advertising. And then that's going to And then we'll actually get better information. You know, do people like this or are they finding it eerie and creepy and trying to opt out?
Well, it completely depends on a data set that I don't know that LinkedIn has right now. And that is whether or not you're happy in your current employment. Because if you are, then right, this is going to seem spammy. And if you're not, then maybe it gets you thinking. Yeah.
Well, this is interesting, right? Because I think LinkedIn has, you know, algorithms that have ways to know whether people are happy. I mean, are you mm-hmm. checking jobs on LinkedIn? Are you suddenly increasing your contacts with other people? Are you moving from having more contacts with people within your company to without? So I think that these companies have a lot more information based on usage patterns than people think they have. So we'll see what happens with that. It is very interesting. It's like when Twitter released a survey that said that they know when people sleep, mostly right, because they're not tweeting. So so I think that was an interesting window into how usage patterns turn into data points that companies are able to use to monetize or use for some other purposes.
Yeah, those are really excellent points. Evan, what do you think about LinkedIn advertising to you with yourself?
Wait. First things first here. Larry was talking about what breaking news is and is not or should be and should not be. I want to let everybody know that Tom Cruise and Katie Holmes are divorcing. That is is news.
Oh,
I guess we shouldn't call it breaking news because we all have access to it now. But that's stuff that can affect your life immediately. Not a Supreme Court decision, which takes years to affect your life. But that is here and now concretized.
It'll affect your work output, certainly.
My afternoon is shot.
Yeah.
So I love stories like this one that Kashmir wrote about LinkedIn using your own image to advertise to you because it took me by surprise. And it's wonderfully intriguing when things like that happen because you think, oh, yeah, that's weird. That's creepy. You know, everything that Lauren said. And then the natural impulse for legal types is to think of the legal analysis and the best, the most fruitful outcome in a legal analysis would seem to be evaluating it under a right of publicity claim. Is LinkedIn using your image and your name to for a commercial purpose in a way that violates the law? And so I looked up the Illinois Right of Publicity Act just for reference. It's a lot. It has language that's a lot like Right of Publicity Acts in other states, and kind of mirrors common law doctrines for those states that don't have it. And it defines commercial purpose as the public use or holding out of an individual's identity. And it goes on to give a little more breadth to that. But it all rises and falls on, as a Right of Publicity Act should, I guess, you know, whether the holding out or the use of the identity is public. So then the analysis gets a little bit more focused and evaluates whether, you know, LinkedIn's use of this identity, the user, is a public holding out. And it seems like it would be pretty hard to argue that it is a public holding out of the individual's identity if the only way this can be seen is through the user authenticated experience or the authenticated user experience. How can you say that this is public if really that communication, that special time between that bonds the user and LinkedIn, you know, that is something that's just between LinkedIn and the user. So that seems to me to be, for the legal analysis, where it rises and falls. And I would say that this is not an invasion of the right of publicity. And I'm sure LinkedIn's counsel spent a lot of time thinking about that before. So there's nothing new under the sun with what I'm saying here. But then just real quickly, I mean, it doesn't this make sense? I mean, when we think about it's so easy for us to get lost and ensnared in the legalisms and all this stuff and how the law should be applied. Let's just back up a little bit here. The whole notion of protecting one's right of publicity is for the protection of that person's dignity or their privacy or, you know, their feelings about all this stuff. So how are your feelings getting hurt? How is the esteem that you enjoy in your community affected by LinkedIn's use of your image to market to yourself? And clearly it is not. It only just might make you feel a little bit like there are voices in your head or something. That's the worst. But it doesn't affect you in relationship with other people. So just for normative reasons, that it shouldn't be a right of publicity cause of action either.
What do you think about all this, Larry?
Well, you know, I'm almost at the age now where I don't really care so much about a right to be forgotten. I'm really looking for the right to remember because I'm starting to forget more and more things that I don't want to forget. I think we have all forgotten, by the way, that LinkedIn actually started this. I wrote several months ago about a pilot program that they did where they were using other people's faces in ads targeted to you from your network. You know, they'd read this article or they'd done it. And then they got a lot of flack for it and they backed off, I think, very quickly. And that may be one difference between, you know, how sort of Facebook responds to its user community and how LinkedIn responds to its. But they did it. They did it, too. Mm-hmm. You know, Evan's right. First of all, it's important to note that this is a state law matter. There's no federal right of publicity the way, you know, say you have copyright as a federal law. And so it does vary by states. But the general trend, certainly in the common law and even with, you know, state statutes about rights of publicity, is that they are becoming weaker, not stronger, with the exception of, say, in New York and California for celebrities. The right of publicity is part of one area where privacy law is expanding through the common law or through state statutory law. But as a matter of kind of, you know, individual users and consumers, it's certainly not a growing area of law. And the truth is, I think it's probably much simpler than Evan has made it sound, which is, I'm sure, you know, if you go back through the terms of service, whatever the licensing agreement that members of LinkedIn have, you know, you've probably, whatever right you might have had here, you've waived it, or you've licensed to them the right to do exactly what they're doing. If you haven't, then, you know, they're going to rewrite the terms of service to make sure that you do in the future. So just mm-hmm. as a matter of contract between you and LinkedIn, you almost assuredly have given them permission to do this and many more things that they're not yet doing.
Right. And I think Lauren's point about what they can glean from your activities simply on the site, you know, not actively confessing to them any close secrets or thoughts, feelings, and sentiments about your job, but simply the way you navigate around and use the site, that it's quite a treasure trove of information. Just to round out this theme of the right to be forgotten for now, I'm sure we'll probably come back to it because it comes out a lot. I saw this wonderful instance of making lemons from lemonade, and that will be our first CLA phrase for the show. Lemons from lemonade is someone, a restaurant, decided that they were going to take a Yelp review and turn it into their advertising. Now, who knows what sort of copyright or right of publicity concerns they may run into if they're calling this user's comment an endorsement without his permission. But what their little sandwich board out on the sidewalk says is, come in and try the worst meatball sandwich that one guy on Yelp ever had in his life.
Awesome.
All those negative comments out there can work in your favor. So we're here today with Larry Downs and Lauren Gelman and Evan Brown, and we're going to take a break and thank our sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, which is ShareFile. And ShareFile is sort of right in the sweet spot of what we're talking about, keeping things private that should be private and yet needing to share them, because with ShareFile, you can easily and securely send everything that you need to via email, except for it's, you know, using your email client, which your customers are going to be used to communicating you with, but it's also leveraging the power of a very secure backend on the web. You know, in business, we rely on sending and receiving important materials through the email every day. But there's a lot of risk in placing large and confidential files as regular attachments. There's no guarantee your attachment's going to go through. If it's too big, it probably won't. And you're not sure who's going to access those files. That's why when I have these kinds of problems, I use ShareFile by Citrix. It's the better way to send and receive files of almost any size. With it, you can easily and securely send everything from large documents, spreadsheets, PowerPoint presentations, videos, document productions, anything that's going to be a great big old bandwidth hog and perhaps reach your email's data cap. Files are sent as a link. There are no more bounce backs. You can even track when it's downloaded, who has seen it, and set access controls that are very fine-grained. We talk a lot on this show about how it's great to give users fine-grained and easy-to-understand control over how things are going to be used and accessed. And ShareFile does that, just that. It also allows you to store your files on the cloud so you can access them from anywhere, your laptop, your tablet, or your smartphone. So it's a great mobility tool, too. It's perfect for sending everything from legal files to confidential contracts. In my law practice, when I've got to get that big document over to a client or opposing counsel, it's the only way I go. So to get you started, I have a special offer. Sign up today and you'll get a 30-day risk-free trial. Go to ShareFile.com and you click on the radio microphone you'll see there. Enter the promo code TWIL, T-W-I-L. It's just as easy as that. Visit ShareFile.com, type in the promo code TWIL. You're going to get a 30-day risk-free trial. And it's a great service. We thank them so much for their support of This Week in Law. All right, Larry, we need to hear from you about the latest threat to a useful and open and somewhat unregulated internet, and how the UN and the ITU are involved in that. And why don't you start with, we were talking a bit before we came on the show, about this conference we were at, the Tech Policy Summit, and things that were being leaked in real time there that you were keeping track of. What has happened here?
So this is, you know, and I sort of feel like Chicken Little sometimes because, you know, I went from SOPA to CISPA. Now I'm talking about the UN and the International Telecommunications Union, which is an agency of the UN. It always seems like as soon as we get past one stupid, dumb, you know, ill-thought-out threat by a governmental activity to, you know, save the internet, which would actually wreck the internet, we've got another one that comes right along. Unfortunately, that's the case. The United Nations, the ITU, is in the process of renegotiating its main treaty, which is called the ITR, very unhelpfully. And this treaty has not been looked at since the 1980s, of course, before there was commercial internet traffic to deal with. Up to now, this agency has largely dealt with the telegraph, and now it's dealt with the international telephone interconnection and things of that nature. And it's a typical UN agency. It's very bureaucratic. It's, you know, very slow moving. It does things in a very non-democratic way. All the countries that are members of the UN each get exactly one vote, depending, regardless of, you know, how much activity they do or don't do, or, you know, the size of their economies, whatever it is, it's one vote for every country. And as part of this renegotiation of the main treaty that will take place at the end of the year in Dubai, the ITU and some different combinations of countries are looking for ways of expanding their authority and their jurisdiction into some level of regulation of internet traffic, of IP addresses, of domain names, whatever basically they can get their hands on. And unfortunately, it's for very different reasons in some cases. For the ITU itself, you know, like any agency, they just want more things to regulate, the bigger budget and bigger authority and things of that nature. But for some countries, particularly Iran, China, and Russia, they see this as a good opportunity to get kind of official UN sanctioned activities for interfering with internet traffic, for, you know, looking at what their citizens are doing, for stopping traffic at the border so they can investigate it before it goes through to make sure it's not dangerous. Of course, dangerous, you know, for them is something different than dangerous for other kinds of countries. Some countries, particularly in Europe, are seeing this as an opportunity to change the economic rules of the game and try to get more out of U.S. internet companies who are more successful than they are, and it's just a huge mess. And the biggest problem, I think, for, you know, average internet users like us is it's all secret. This is one of these treaties. ACTA was a similar problem where the negotiations, all the documents, everything, it's supposed to be kept secret. It's not, you know, there's no law being broken here. It's not espionage or, you know, treason to do this, but the documents are not supposed to be leaked. Fortunately, the U.S. here in particular, and this one goes across the spectrum, it's Republicans, it's Democrats, it's Congress, it's the FCC, it's the White House, the State Department. We're all on the same page here, at least so far, that this process is a very dangerous one, that the treaty that we could see at the end of the year could be a very bad one. And so there are a lot of, you know, a lot of people want to make sure that the public sees as much of this as possible. And so fortunately, some of the most dangerous documents have started to leak out from a variety of sources. And of course, that's led to some reporting. Declan McCullough and I on CNET broke a story the day of the conference that you're talking about, Denise, about a big proposal from European Telecommunications Network Operators Association, where they were trying to sort of levy a tax on incoming internet traffic and so on. And this has started to generate a lot of publicity. And so other documents are now leaking out. There's a site run by two researchers at the George Mason University called WikiLeaks, which is WCITLEAKS, Wicket being the name of this conference that's working on the new treaty. And they're posting documents as they get them. And it's starting to have an effect. It certainly hasn't ended this process. But, you know, the ITU is now kind of on the defensive, and they're saying, oh, well, you know, we don't share these documents because the member states won't let us, and we're not trying to take over the internet, and it's foolish to say we are. And I take that as a good sign, at least now that we're getting some engagement. It was hard earlier in the year, back in January and February, when the treaty process started, couldn't really get any press attention. And again, we didn't have any of the documents to point to as smoking guns. Now the leaks are coming. We're now getting the smoking guns. And hopefully the, you know, the internet user community worldwide, because I think this is just as much a danger to users outside the U.S. as inside the U.S., hopefully that user community will rise up much the same way in the U.S. we had with the SOPA thing, and make it clear to their governments, make it clear to their telco companies, make it clear to their, you know, public advocacy groups that they are paying attention. They know what's going on. They're not going to allow a bunch of bureaucrats and UN officials and, you know, sort of interested parties economically to mess up the internet with a bad treaty.
So from the documents that have leaked and the information you've seen so far, how does this stand to manifest itself in a concrete way? What's the kind of thing you expect to see if indeed this goes ahead as planned and people do not sort of rise up and make their voice known that they don't want this to happen and manage to put the brakes on?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, there are hundreds of proposals now floating around, and there's a very poorly defined process for how those proposals get winnowed down to a manageable list that will actually be debated and negotiated at the treaty conference in December. So we don't know which of these proposals will even survive to that point. But certainly some of the worst ones, you know, as I say, a lot of them coming from more repressive governments that are using this as a way of kind of clamping down on internet speech from their own citizens, as well as access to outside speech from other countries. Some of those proposals may make it into the treaty. Some of these economic proposals, taxes on internet use or taxes on traffic, may make it. Some more technical things may make it, like the ITU wants some level of authority over IP address distribution and possibly over domain name activities that currently takes place entirely within ICANN. We may wind up at the end of December, because, again, every country gets the same vote. And there are weird coalitions that are forming, we may get a very bad draft treaty that has some, you know, very dangerous proposals, I think counterproductive in many ways. The danger, I think, is not that this treaty will go into effect, because the U.S. certainly won't approve. You know, it's very hard to get treaties approved. You need two-thirds of the Senate to ratify it. The treaty would almost certainly not get ratified by the Senate if it comes in with any of these really repressive or economically damaging or technically damaging features to it. But the problem is that even if that happens, other countries can ratify the treaty. And when you're, let's say, a U.S. Internet company or a U.S. communications company, and you now are trying to negotiate peering arrangements or content delivery network arrangements with companies in other countries, they will have that version of the treaty that passed, and they'll, you know, hold us to it or hold our companies to it. The result may wind up being, which nobody would want, a splintered internet where we have sort of, you know, different versions of the internet depending on which version of the treaty was accepted by which countries.
I think that's called splinternet, by the way. some nomenclature for you.
Absolutely. Beatmaster in our IRC, one of our regular viewers and active IRC participants, has a question wondering if a deal of such importance can be done in public. Countries like China, North Korea, and so on, he says, or speculates, will act much tougher in the open than in certain secrecy. What do you think of that, Larry?
Well, that's possible. I'm not a, you know, sort of expert on foreign relations here, but my general view is that, as the saying goes, you know, sunshine is the best anesthetic. The more transparent this process is, I think the harder it's going to be for some of the most ridiculous proposals to make it to the conference in December, some of the economic ones, as well as some of the political ones as well. I mean, you know, the United States has made it clear, as I say, Republican, Democrat, all levels and all branches of government are clear that they are against any of these kinds of repressive proposals making it into the UN's treaty. But I think it's harder for them to fight that when much of it is secret. And frankly, I think the more of it that leaks out, the more we as U.S. citizens will kind of put pressure on our own representatives, the delegation that's going to this conference, which is led by the State Department and the Commerce Department. We will, you know, put more pressure on them not to be so polite. And so far, their responses to some of the worst proposals have been, well, we don't support that, you know, but we understand the concerns sort of thing. I think the more it becomes public, the more the U.S. will be pressured by its own citizens, as it should be, into taking a harder stance and making clear that these proposals are dangerous politically, socially, economically, across the board.
Well, I've been really impressed in listening to you talk about all this and how you and Declan McCullough were doing the reporting as things were coming out in real time. And in your response to my question about, you know, how exactly is this a threat? Well, we don't really know, but here are the ways that it could be based on what we know, that you guys have made a nice counterexample for reporting things in real time on limited information to what we saw and we were discussing earlier in the show. I take it you guys have avoided a Dewey beats Truman moment in the way you've gotten this information out there.
So far, yes.
So no, we'll go ahead.
I was going to say, you know, obviously we were careful. And I must say the article that you're referring to, Declan mm-hmm. and I, of course, we had each other to challenge. And he said, you know, sure, we can say this and, you know, really say that. But we were up, you know, we got documents leaked to us early in the day. And I think we were up till about midnight together, you know, through Google Docs working on it. And then the editor came in and he started questioning, you know, are you sure this fact? And that's, of course, what good journalism is. We were able to do it in less than a day. And that's partly because of the wonders of technology that we can publish something, you know, as soon as we're done with the text. But we certainly weren't going to start reporting on the document before we'd had a full opportunity to read it. And by the way, to ask the in this case, the European telco companies for their response, for, you know, we did interviews. Yes, I think we can do journalism more quickly now in the age of technology, but, you know, we still have to do it right.
See, this principle just never goes away of talking too quick. As soon as I said SplinterNet, I was all thinking, what a good boy am I? What a clever thing it is. I look it up. There's like Doc Searles has been using this term for years, and there's actually a Wikipedia article about SplinterNet. So there you go. We all just need to maybe there's an app for just like pausing 30 seconds between the time of the thought and the word comes out.
No, but then we'd never say anything. And we're going to make Dewey Beats Truman our second CLE phrase for the show for folks who are hoping to get some professional education credit, either in the legal field or in other fields from listening to TWIL. We're thrilled that you do that. And we have some information over on the wiki at wiki.twit.tv for how you can do that if you're not already availing yourself of that opportunity. Let's talk about the Project Glass that came out this week. Google's glasses that are hopefully going to solve your problem, Larry, of wanting to remember more than you forget by putting information, you know, even more at our fingertips. And maybe it'll solve your problem too, Evan, of being able to instantaneously see whether and who is using the term you've just thought that you've coined. Mm-hmm. Google's let a bunch of information about the project out, has actually let other people wear the glasses, and is doing some promotion of it. It has a Google Plus page, and mostly people seem to view this as just, you know, a logical extension of how we all tote our smartphones and other mobile, always connected devices along with us. But Lauren, I'm a little curious as to whether this seems to me another sort of blurry edge technology here, to coin the term of your business. That's because I think, you know, as you start to wear things that can both capture people on film and give you instantaneous knowledge and collect information about you as you go through your life, you start to get into some interesting area. Do you agree?
Oh, I think this is very interesting. The really interesting thing about our stories is that they're about other people. They're about our interactions in life and then our reflection on that and then our interactions based on that reflection. And here you have a very interesting way to capture that whole process. And by its very nature, you're going to be capturing, you know, the process as experienced by other people. I mean, that's always, of course, the interesting thing about pictures, which is the only person who definitely does not own any copyright interest in the picture is the person in the picture. Here you're going to have sort of everyone captured by these glasses except the person wearing the glasses. You know, I mean, obviously they're in the experience, but it's, you know, it'll be very interesting to see how people, you know, when people will put these glasses on and how others will react to seeing somebody wearing them. Again, they're a very good example of visceral notice, which is to say, you know, when somebody's wearing these glasses, they're not designed to create a covert situation. But I mean, I love the idea of the particular image of sharing with like the grandparents an afternoon of playing with the kids in a way that allows them to really experience it differently than just a photograph. But from a privacy perspective, this raises lots of interesting flags.
Right. And I think as they are designed now, you know, if you're a technologically savvy person and you pay attention to what devices are out there and whether those glasses are simply augmenting someone's eyesight or doing something else, then you'd know what they were. But I think they could readily be designed to be more sort of stealth mode. And that there would be a whole bunch of people out there that would just see you wearing funny glasses and have no idea what they were capable of. Larry, I'm with you. You know, my gray matter is flagging on a daily basis, and I, you know, definitely rely on devices to keep me informed and advised and correct me and on track and all that stuff. How do you feel about these?
Well, you know, I mean, I love Google. I love companies like Google that are always pushing the envelope and that are looking for new things that I wouldn't have never thought of in a million years. Invariably, when you're talking about information, and particularly as you're talking about more personal and even intimate information, you always have what people refer to as the creepy factor. Mm-hmm. When new applications, new devices, new uses come out, and some of them it's large, it's very small, but I think it's just natural human response to kind of be a little creeped out about something new that gets to something very intimate or very personal about you. And I just remind myself, and I've been around long enough and certainly been working in information technology long enough, that I know that there's a sort of a duration to the how long that creepy factor lasts. It, you know, depends on how big the change is, but it always eases off, it always ends. And I always try to tell myself, well, before I have a kind of a visceral response or an emotional response or jump to any conclusion, this is the end of the world or this is the end of privacy or this is, you know, a bad thing, or, you know, just kind of give it a few weeks or a few months for people to use it and play with it and then decide whether or not, yeah, you know, we can get used to this, or actually the costs don't outweigh the benefits. And I usually find that I can calm myself down long enough to try something and you know, give it a fair trial before I decide it's it's apocalyptic.
Right. And what generally winds up happening is, you know, some sort of unanticipated situation, or anticipated but, you know, unhoped for, comes up, and the social mores and the technical mores around such a device, you know, would change to be able to address that. You know, like camera phones, they come defaulted with the, you know, my son very well knows when I'm taking a picture of a movie of him. He sees me holding the thing in front of me. Oftentimes he can hear the click or whatever, you know, triggers the recording. And he generally runs for the hills. You know, he has enough pictures taken of him. So I think these are going to, you know, probably be harder to detect than that sort of situation. So that's where a creepy factor comes in for me. And gosh, Evan, you know, if Lauren's students are nervous now, what happens when everybody around them is, you know, relying on this kind of technology to help them through their academic career? And there's a whole lot of side effect that can happen with them.
Yeah, that's definitely one area where technology like this would need to be regulated when there is a certain practical limitation on the knowledge that one should have available to them for purposes of, well, I guess testing is the most obvious one, like that. So I have a sense that at least for the next few years, there's going to be a practical limitation on the adoption of these technologies, like what we see with these glasses. And that is based on just the fundamental structures of the brain and how much we can handle psychologically and how much sensory input and informational input we can tolerate and meaningfully process. I mean, these are devices to augment our reality, but the most important fundamental aspect of that is reality and what that really is. And so we're equipped with our brains at the way they are. And so as we're approaching the singularity, you know, we'll see more and more technologies like this, but until the singularity is actually here and the ability for, I think it's going to happen through nano devices being able to cross the blood-brain barrier and get in and actually augment the way the brain itself works, we're going to be limited in our capacity to take in information and sensory inputs. And so there's going to be a point at which there's a diminishing return on these things, and which is a good thing. So all, you know, everything pre-singularity, we're just going to have to worry about regulating certain controlled environments, like what we're talking about with academia. You don't want somebody wearing these glasses or some kind of device like that to help them out, kind of in the same way you don't want somebody to have access to a web browser and an internet connection if they're taking a test. I mean, there's really no fundamental difference between augmenting your reality by having, you know, access to the internet. This is just kind of shortening the time that it takes to get that information, reducing some of the friction of the interface, is, I guess, is one way of putting it. So everything pre-singularity is going to just be easily regulable. After that, it's anybody's guess how we're going to regulate anything, let alone this.
Well, pre-singularity, I think we're going to have the funny situation of, you know, several states have already in Nevada or are looking into legalizing the auto-driving Google car. So you're in your Google car and you have your Google glasses on, and my head just starts to explode at that point. I say that kind of facetiously, but I do think that these glasses would have an interesting legal consideration in ordinary cars that don't drive themselves, you know, that perhaps they could add features, you know, that would enhance the driving experience. And at the same time, you know, you're going to want the driver's full attention on the road. And I'm sure states would be, you know, very nervous. It would be worse than using your cell phone in the car in some ways. Lauren, any thoughts on that?
Well, I think there are two ways this is going to develop. On the legal side, at some point, we're going to have to push this notion that everything is public, and that everything that's done in a public place is able to be recorded and reused in any way possible. And so right now, we are sort of on one end of the spectrum there. And I think there's also the line of social norms, which is to say, you know, where will it be acceptable to wear these glasses, and where are there places that it just won't? And how I think norms are going to sort of develop in that accompany the technology, that and the law will probably change in some ways to not permit recording in all situations. And these things will all just combine in new ways as the technologies develop. So what's really hard is to try to anticipate that now when you don't really know what people's expectations are. And that's why I think the more that, the analogy that you used between, like, people know when a phone is taking a picture, what that means. People go to parties mm-hmm. now. Everybody has phones. There's a sort of changed expectation about how private you are at a party or even just walking down the street. You know, these you know, people watch Law and Order and see how they can go to the ATM machines and get the video of what's going on. So it's become, I think, you know, it's just all these different things are coming together in different ways. And I think knowing about technologies like Google Glasses in advance of them becoming readily available allows us to hopefully be thoughtful about how they're integrated and how social norms develop. So that, you know, I mean, I don't think there should be cameras in dorms. I think kids in college should be able to do stuff and not have it be recorded if that's what they want. I think there should be some baselines where we say there are certain things that are necessary to a free society, one being that to develop an interested and engaging mind, you need to be able to explore different things. And those kinds of things happen in the dorms, and we shouldn't record that for posterity. We should allow people to put that part of their life behind them if they choose. It's going to be harder and harder as all these different, you know, as the Internet of Things, as sensors and mobile devices and cars and glasses capture all this data about us. But I still think there should be some lines that are drawn. And, you know, whether those lines are drawn through the law, through design of the technology, or through just, you know, how we interact with each other, politeness, social norms. It's the coming together of all these things. It's going to be very interesting.
Yes, Perfection in IRC says he wants the contact lens version of this. And I guess it's worth throwing into the mix that just this week, Google Plus augmented itself with an events feature. And one of the aspects of that is this real-time event photo sharing ability. So if you have an event and people have opted into being there on Google Plus, all their photos taken at the event go into this pool, and you have this sort of, you know, instead of one person's party pictures, you have them all in one place. And of course, you know, you throw the glasses into the mix and that starts to be fairly interesting. And you throw the dorm into the mix, and maybe, as Lauren says, it's something that should be, you know, left off the public web. Larry, any final thoughts before we move on?
No, I'd like the contact lens version of that myself.
All right. Well, we'll stay tuned for that. Larry, another interesting and constantly developing area of technology these days is how we're all consuming entertainment. And there was a hearing in Washington this week on the future of video. Can you bring us up to speed on what happened there?
Sure. I mean, it was sort of one of the usual slugfests of different industry groups, asking Congress to regulate the other side in a way that would be useful to their business interests. Congress is very interested in trying to understand what it can do, obviously, to help make it a better, more efficient market for getting video of all kinds of content out as part of its overall idea that, you know, universal access to broadband internet will help us in many, many ways. And this even goes back to the National Broadband Plan a couple of years ago. I think one of the things that few people probably know who don't follow this area of law is that, in fact, there's still a great deal of kind of old regulation of the cable industry and of the telephone industry and of the broadcast industry. In fact, you know, obviously we see some of that in the cases about fleeting expletives in the Supreme Court case earlier this term on that. And the problem is that a lot of those regulations, everyone's in complete agreement, including the FCC, including Congress, Republicans and Democrats, that the regulatory structure we have now is completely obsolete in the sense that it doesn't reflect the reality that, of course, we all get our entertainment now or other media now in a variety of ways through kind of converged internet networks. So, I mean, watching it on the phone, we're watching it on a computer, we're watching it on the television. Television comes to us, some of it comes from the cable, but some of it comes over the top through things like Netflix and Hulu. Some of it we just get from the computer. And the way in which the entertainment industry is regulated today is all very splintered. It's some of it, you know, by cable rules, some of it's telephone rules, I say. And everyone agrees that the current structure is obsolete. Of course, what we can't agree on is what we should do instead. And depending on what side of the fence you're sitting on here, you either want more regulation or less regulation. And in either case, you think that's the solution that will make it easier for consumers to get what they want, where they want it, how they want it, at the lowest possible price. So at this hearing that was held on Wednesday in the House, you had the head of the cable industry, Michael Powell, who's the former chairman of the FCC, saying, you know, look, the rules about retransmission and must carry and all this obscure stuff at the state as well as the federal level is actually making it harder for consumers to get the kinds of options and flexibility they want in cable programming, or I should say in content that comes down through the cable itself, whatever the content is. And then you had the CEO of Netflix there saying, oh, you know, they're trying to kill our business and we really need more extreme regulation to save us. And it was sort of that kind of fight that we have it, you know, every few months. It comes under a different title. Sometimes it's called net neutrality. Sometimes it's called, you know, they talk about it in terms of the data cap. Sometimes it's about must carry and retransmission consent. But it really is the same fight, which is we all know that the current content regulations don't make any sense in an internet world. We just don't know what to replace them with and how quickly.
Okay, so Evan, where do you stand on all of this? Do you think we should just scrap all of this admittedly antiquated legislation and regulation that doesn't really address the current state of affairs? And how do you feel about the complaints of people like the CEOs of Netflix and Roku that, you know, they're just not able to compete on a level playing field right now?
Yeah, well, that's I like the way you I object to your question. That was obviously a loaded question. How am I supposed to possibly say, ah, screw them, you know, Netflix, yeah. They don't matter. So if we're going to start from the premise that they cannot compete in the marketplace the way it is because of some built-in way that the infrastructure is, and by infrastructure I mean the regulatory system, not the actual infrastructure that they're building and all that stuff, then, you know, yes, we definitely have to change things. These are such, and I've got a preface anything more that I say with, like, you know, Larry Downs is on the call here, so I'm not expecting to say anything that's going to add too much to this. But, you know, I mean, this is a really fundamental thing that's being regulated here. The means of communication, the means of the way that information gets from one place to the other, using scarce resources to do that. So there has to be a real... it seems like one of the themes that we've been talking about today is, you know, slowing things down and actually thinking things through before we act on them. So, given the fact that alternative content providers, innovators, new digital platforms, you know, trying to emerge here or enjoy some success or be on a level playing field, you know, if there is anything that's anti-competitive or somehow hinders them in a way that is unfair, then there's got to be some change in the way it's done. But don't look to me for what that should look like. It's just got to be measured.
Right. Larry, we've talked about this on the show before, and I think I know how you feel about it, but let's bring it up again. Do you think that Netflix and Roku and other, you know, I guess, are we calling these over-the-top video providers?
Yes.
Do you think they have a point, or that if we rolled things back sufficiently, everything would be open and competitive?
Well, of course, I mean, they have a point in the sense that they don't control the tubes, whatever way you're getting the content, whether it's over cable or fiber or DSL. On the mm-hmm. other hand, one of the reasons they do operate over the top is because that allows them to do so without being regulated by the FCC. So they don't have to, you know, collect crazy taxes to support the Spanish-American War, which, by the way, you're still paying on your phone bill. They don't have to submit to retransmission consent and must carry. And a lot of the other, they don't have to deal with local franchising issues and the corruption of local communities. So there's sort of a yes and a no there. I mean, mm-hmm. I think Evan is underselling himself, because I think he hit the nail right on the head in terms of how we should think about this issue is in terms of competitive harms to consumers. All right. So my general view is, of course, detailed regulation when technology is changing as quickly as it can is always a bad idea. It always leads to unintended consequences. It never works the way you expect it to, because the world is shifting too quickly beneath you. On the other hand, not to say that we should live in a lawless environment, the standard should be, you know, are there practices, are there, you know, is this merger, is this business practice, is this activity having a sort of demonstrable harm to consumers? And if so, that's the way in which, you know, law and regulation should enter. And in fact, we have exactly that standard. It's the standard for antitrust. And so in some sense, what I would say is, yes, I would like to get rid of, you know, clear the rubble of you know, a couple of decades worth of FCC rules and regulations dealing with these separate mediums and these separate channels and these separate forms of content that are no longer separate. Let's just clear away that rubble. And instead of replacing it with a new set of rules that will quickly become obsolete, let's take the FCC out of this equation altogether and leave it to the Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission, and in some sense to the states, under an antitrust standard, where we say, you know, if there's a harm that we can prove that it's, you know, it's raising prices for consumers or some other kind of, you know, really clear harm, then we can fashion an appropriate remedy on a case-by-case basis. I think when you're talking about the kinds of changes in this industry, but other industries as well, that's really the only way. You're not going to get perfect response, by the way. It's not a perfect solution, but it's a much better approach than trying to, you know, kind of close each barn door after each horse leaves and say, okay, oh, that end run, you can't do that anymore. And now you have to do this. And then we're stuck with that rule 10 years later when it doesn't make any sense.
So, Lauren, it strikes me what we're seeing today under the current regime is a different kind of splinter net, where it's sort of death by a thousand cuts from a thousand devices, where, you know, if you have certain programming in mind you want to get to, you might be able to get it on your cable or your Roku or your Apple TV. You know, I mean, it's just kind of a very strange world out there today where you can't, there's so much fragmentation that this notion of Evans that he raised, that, you know, there is this important interest in getting information out to people, sort of gets lost in the shuffle. Do you think that Larry's proposal of scaling back regulation, except for the antitrust rubric, would help solve that problem?
I'm just not sure. I think there's so many different business models out there right now that there's a lot to be said for just letting businesses hack it out. But you know, it's not as easy to compete against the incumbents as the sort of nostalgia of the you know, inventor in the garage makes it seem. So I think it's you know, it's hard to say where things will play out. You know, I have a lot of companies that come to me and they have good ideas and they have like radical ways of transforming, you know, how we get content and how we see content and connecting different devices together and throwing content from one device to the next and everything talking to each other. But, you know, they're still playing in an environment that is, in, you know, regulated by legacy and maintained by a few people. So I definitely am in favor of pushing the antitrust stuff as far as it can go. I'm not sure what on top of that we should be looking for.
Yeah, it sounds like a sensible approach to me, because so much of what's out there now just seems to not even anticipate the technological world we live in today. Let's talk about, Larry, what's going on at the FCC on special access broadband. Does that have any relationship to what we're discussing now?
It does. I mean, it's part of the same problem, which is the ways in which the FCC regulates. And I don't blame the commission or its staff for this. It's really what Congress set up in successive versions of their statute. But essentially, they regulate as if we still lived in a world where telephone and television and radio and satellite and all these technologies did different things with different content. So what happened this week was the FCC was set to vote on a proposal that was being circulated by Chairman Jenikowski to essentially reopen the whole regulatory structure of how the FCC does or doesn't regulate the middle mile of the internet and what's sometimes called special access. The most important application for that, that I think you know everybody would understand, is this is partly how we get backhaul of cell phone or you know any kind of wireless traffic that has to actually go through the wired network to get then onto another tower to get to a wireless user on the other side. Right now, it's a you know hopeless old set of regulations that were intended for dealing with telephone traffic. It has nothing to do with data traffic, and the problem here is that. There's a big change happening technologically. Right now, most of the backhaul happens over the legacy copper system at relatively slow circuits, 1.5 megabit per second circuits. In big cities, but increasingly across the nation, we're moving to new technology based on fiber loops. In fact, that's how I'm talking to you today from New Mexico. I'm directly hooked into a fiber that's going through Albuquerque. And there are new competitors. The cable system is doing some of this now. There are new startups. It's actually quite a vibrant environment. And the FCC is right to say we really need to step back and look at the whole problem again. My preferred solution would be that they stay out of regulation and indeed that they get rid of some of the last bit of regulation they still do in this area. Others want them to get more active and more aggressive in sort of setting up the competitive market for special access. But what they did this week was they kind of, I think, smartly decided, well, we're not going to vote on this proposal that would freeze current situation for the wireline companies. What we're instead going to do is circulate an order soon that will start a much bigger data collection process where we can actually find out what the special access market looks like today, how's it evolving, who are the main players, you know, how is competition working or not working before they start tinkering with the machinery.
All right. Let me ask you, because I'm just sort of fascinated, stuck on something you said a minute ago, how exactly that connecting straight into the fiber works. Did you, you know, stick some kind of special tuning fork in there or how are you communicating with us today?
No, I'm actually at the offices of a wireless internet service provider, Higher Speed Net in Moriarty, New Mexico, and they, like many, the WISPs are a great way, particularly in rural areas, for getting internet access out. They have a fiber connection that starts here, so they're directly linked to the fiber, and then they use unlicensed spectrum with a series of antennas in the general area to get in and out traffic from their fiber hub here to consumers in a very, you know, very sparsely populated, largely rural area here in New Mexico. So rather than, you know, sort of work off the unlicensed spectrum part, I decided better just come right to the source here and plug directly into the fibers. In fact, I'm on a wireless connection in the office, but it's going to a 5 gigabit fiber connection. So
look great.
Much better than at home. Much better than at home.
Yeah. Interesting.
That's pretty cool. So it's Verizon Fios for the rest of us.
That's right.
Who can't get it. That sounds very intriguing. All right. Let's talk about following up on what's been going on in your neck of the woods, Evan. Judge Posner has been considering whether or not to let the Apple versus Motorola case go forward, and we reported on his earlier decisions. He had a Daubert hearing in the case, which assesses the damages testimony that would be set forth by the party's experts. And having considered that and all of the briefing and arguments of the parties, he's thrown the case out with prejudice, finally, in a lengthy opinion that I will give you full transparent disclosure on. I have only sort of scratched the surface of. There is quite a bit of meat to get into there on why he thinks that no harm or damage or injunctive relief would be available in this case were it to go to trial. Evan, you want to comment on this and further bring us up to speed?
Well, you pretty much summarized it there in the most meaningful way that I could. Judge Posner opinions are sometimes difficult to read. He's very interesting in his style of writing, very straightforward. There's a great economy in his writing style. So the fact that he wrote this 38-page opinion says a lot about the fact that there is a lot of substance to it. But really, I think the simplest way to understand it, and it's the way that I'm understanding it, is that there was little use in going forward with a trial when there weren't going to be any meaningful damages. And when I say meaningful damages, I mean, you know, like more than nominal damages, a dollar or something like that. And so it didn't make any sense to go forward. And Judge Posner had been making those rumblings for at least a couple of weeks, issuing that kind of a bit, not necessarily conventional, unconventional, I guess would be the word, really quick order saying, I'm inclined to dismiss this. Then he had the parties back in for a hearing on the injunctive relief, and then finally issued a more substantive ruling that articulates why a trial should not happen because of the entitlement of recovery of damages or injunctive relief. So it's it looks like it's a slightly better situation for Motorola/Google in this situation. Certainly, Motorola isn't under the gun as far as having a whole category of its operations delayed while it has to work around some Apple technology. That's at least not going to have to happen. So it's something I would leave it to the smart guys over at The Verge and at other places who, like Matt McCary, to really talk about how this affects the industry, but certainly is not a trivial development in the overall landscape of the patent wars.
No, and there's an interesting twist to this because Judge Posner, acting in a trial court capacity here, pointed out that this is likely to be appealed, and when it is appealed, it will be to his colleagues on the Seventh Circuit, and he has written, you know, a lengthy and very well-reasoned, well-thought-out, appellate justification for what he's done here, so that when it does come up for review by his colleagues, you know, I think that the chances of this getting set aside are slightly lower, shall we say, than your standard run-of-the-mill district court opinion and order that gets reviewed by the Court of Appeals. Larry, have you taken a look at this, and do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I have read the opinion, and I should start with a disclosure and a correction. My disclosure is I worked as Judge Posner's law clerk in the early 1990s, so I have a pretty good idea of how he takes on these matters. And my correction is one of your IRC listeners has pointed out that the Spanish-American war tax was, in fact, finally put to bed in 2006, so you're not actually still paying that on your phone
bill. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Look, you know, the bottom line is very simple. In the world of patents, and particularly in the world of these unbelievably complicated cell phone related patent wars, whenever a case gets even close to going to trial, something has gone very wrong for both parties. Nobody is expecting, nobody wants any of these cases to go to trial. They are largely, you know, these very complex negotiations, and there are patent pools involved here, and there are essential patents, all these other things that sort of the patent bar and the parties have built up to try and protect themselves from the kind of craziness of the patent system and how really very broad many of these patents are. Many of them are defensive patents. It's a total mess. There's no real solution to it. But the last thing that anybody wants is for these cases to go to trial. And something clearly had gone wrong that it even got close to trial. And that's why I think in some ways it was very easy for Judge Posner to say, you know, the patents that are still remaining here We can't really, you know, you can't point to me any indication that you would be able to claim significant damages. And of course, if you can't, you know, give me a plausible reason why there would be damages, then there's no point to having a trial. In fact, I'm obliged not to have a trial under those circumstances. Now, who really wins and loses here? I think, you know, in some ways, I would guess that both Apple and Google are relieved that this is not going to trial, because the outcome couldn't have been particularly good for either party by the time, as I say, it got to this point. Something was very wrong in the negotiations. They really want to, you know, I think in some ways it's good that they're, and I think they would probably be relieved that they're being told, you know, go back to square one, figure out, you know, which of these patents can be, you know, licensed, and figure out the royalties under these strange standards that have developed, and the pools, and all these other doctrines that have come up. I don't really imagine either of these parties really wanted to go to trial or thought that a trial would be in their benefit. I don't know. You know, as you say, they're likely to appeal for, I think, a variety of reasons. And we'll see. You know, I'm not quite as confident, Denise, as you are, that Judge Buzzer's colleagues on the Seventh Circuit will take the fact that he was the trial judge by designation here as a kind of indication that they should really back off. They may or may not do that, but the bottom line here is that the patent system, and particularly with these multiple interlocking cell phone patent fights going on, and some of this, by the way, is going on at the International Trade Commission. It's all over the map here. It's a mess. It's ultimately, you know, very worrisome, I think, for cell phone users and for cell phone customers. This is a, you know, this is an interesting approach to it, of throwing out the case, and hopefully not so much that his appellate colleagues will get the message, but that Judge Posner will be an inspiration here to other trial judges in all the other patent fights that are going on over the cell phone patents, and that they will be more encouraged to throw more of them out before they get too far.
It would be awkward. It would be so awkward at the holiday party if the other judges on the bench.
Yes. How dare you monkey with my opinion and order? No, I didn't mean to suggest that they would back off simply because it was Judge Posner who had written the opinion, but just that he has done the hard work here, that, you know, he's a super wonderful leg up for Motorola, Google's lawyers on appeal, of you know, setting out in great detail his reasoning and justification for how he got to where he got, and that courts of appeal, you know, I think any district court judge would probably be thrilled to have Judge Posner writing the justification for what it is they had done to be able to take up to the court of appeal and say, you know, look at this, how can you argue with this?
Yeah, I mean, so, the truth is that the courts of appeals, I mean, one of the areas where appellate courts in the federal system really hate to get involved is patents. It's so specialized. A lot of it is very technical. Judge Posner has done now, I think, a half a dozen trials having to do with patents, just sitting by designation, you know, because he thinks it's fun. That's why he does it. But also to give him some experience as a trial judge, so he can be more sympathetic and understanding when he's hearing appeals, to know why trial judges sometimes do the things they do. But, you know, he's done actual trials, by the way. He doesn't always throw them out. When a patent case comes to the Court of Appeals, whatever circuit it is, including the Federal Circuit, it's a nightmare. It just to, you know, even understand the facts, it sometimes is about, you know, biotech and so on. Yes, I think appellate judges would be very happy to feel like there was a reasoned opinion that somebody else wrote, so that they don't have to understand it.
Yeah, wait, we're all smoking crack here. Don't all patent cases go to the Federal Circuit?
Yeah, they all go to the Federal Circuit.
So exactly. Forget this awkwardness at the holiday party. They'd be like, oh yeah, great opinion. We'll let the guys in Washington, D.C. take care of it.
Yes, but still.
Sorry for that.
You know, the Posner aspect, I think, would continue to have some influence. Lauren, any thoughts on this before we move on to our last bit of news for the day?
No, just that, you know, it really is amazing how important mobile devices are going to be. And I think these patent wars over the cell phones are just an indication of how seriously the companies are taking anything that has to do with mobile devices. So it will be interesting to see how it plays out. I think it's going to be very important for users and really for how the future of technology goes. you know, what kind of devices are available and how many platforms there are and how many different models there are for ways that you can get content when you're on the go. So, I mean, tie this back to Google Glasses. I think, mm-hmm. you know, there's going to be lots of different kinds of glasses and there are as many different kinds of devices. And I'm generally of the view that the more different models that are being played with out there, the better it's going to be in the long run for the users.
Yep, I agree. Although the whole interoperability and access issue comes into play there too.
Right. But I mean, having the iPhone model out there and the Android mm-hmm. model right now is really sort of testing, you know, from security purposes, for privacy purposes, for usability purposes, you know, what the proper relationship should be between the control of the platform and the control of the developers and what kind of controls the user wants to have and should have.
Absolutely. All right, Evan, also interestingly from the district court in Illinois, we have Comcast coming in and moving to quash a bunch of subpoenas with which it was served by various adult entertainment companies seeking access to personal information about users that the plaintiffs here, the adult entertainment companies, wanted to sue, that they suspected of having engaging in illegal downloads of their materials. Comcast moved to quash and said, no, we're not going to turn that stuff over. We don't think we should have to. And actually put some arguments before the court that, hey, these folks are just fishing here. They're trying to shake down these potential defendants. And these defendants, you know, might not even be subject to the jurisdiction of this court here in Illinois. And we think you should just, you know, toss this right out, quash. And I guess also they were coming after Comcast as a defendant. I don't know whether on an indirect liability theory or go ahead.
Filed a motion against Comcast, a motion to show cause as to why it shouldn't mm-hmm. be held in contempt, like Eric Holder kind of contempt for not responding to the subpoena. So that's how Comcast ended up as, you know, having to, you know, quote unquote, defend itself here. And so, you know, a couple of observations on this. One, Comcast, you know, was the beneficiary of some great lawyering by its team on this. It was, you know, Davis Wright Tremaine seems like was the main brains behind this. Some really artful lawyering and all this, because really all it was just some procedural stuff under Rule 45 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure as to why these subpoenas should be quashed. But they very artfully worked in all this talking about how the other side, how the plaintiffs here are on this fishing expedition and how, you know, all these cases are pending down in Florida. Look how rotten that is on the part of the plaintiffs to be issuing these subpoenas from way up here in Illinois because they can't meaningfully defend themselves. So that it's extortionate because people want to get these settlements, you know, they want to settle. And I'm using air quotes because they actually use settlement in quotes in the briefs because of its extortionate nature. So I guess the first point would be good lawyering on Comcast's part by its counsel to get these arguments in there. But at the same time, we as the public or other lawyers who want to litigate this issue have limited utility that we can extract from this because of what the judge did. He issued a minute order. And for those listening who are mm-hmm. not litigation attorneys, what that is just one or two sentences explaining what the ruling is, what the decision is on the motion. It doesn't give any explanation. So he just says, for the reasons stated in open court. Yes. So we know that he was on the bench. And I guess if we wanted to go get the transcript of what went on there, we could. Maybe somebody from EFF or something would want to do that. So we don't have a written opinion that adopts Comcast arguments and says all this stuff. We just have the judge saying, okay, for whatever reason, we can do this. So Comcast certainly had a self-interest in doing this as well. One, maybe to just make it more efficient for it to respond to thousands of subpoenas, you know, maybe from one centralized location or whatever. But also Comcast has a reason to, you know, a public relations reason to want to make sure that this process is kept in check, because Comcast is often the face that these John Doe defendants see, because the first time they're made aware of the fact that they have been named as a John Doe defendant in a lawsuit is a letter from their ISP saying, oh, we've gotten this subpoena. We're going to have to turn over all your information to these pornographers if you don't do something soon. So a lot of times negative energy is directed toward Comcast when all it really is the intermediary in all of this in both senses. So
right.
every good reason for it.
Particularly with the six strikes regime coming into play later on this year, it's nice to see Comcast taking this stand. It's sort of the other side of that coin, I guess. Larry, any thoughts?
No, I think Evan covers it well. I mean, the other thing just to continue to point out is that IP address is still not a particularly good way of identifying a defendant, because obviously an IP address doesn't tell you who was using the computer. It doesn't mm-hmm. even tell you which necessarily computer was being used. It's a shortcut, and often, of course, the IP address relates to a particular user, but it doesn't always. And we should always be looking for ways to remind litigants that that they can't just rely on the IP address as a way of identifying a party, and they should rely less on that, and therefore make fewer of these kinds of requests of ISPs in the first place.
Remind the cops, too. I mean, there's a story I was going to suggest. Maybe we can talk about it in another episode. But just this past week in Evansville, Indiana, the cops, the SWAT team, with the masks and the flash bombs and all that stuff, raided the wrong house because somebody down the street was using its the house's Wi-Fi connection. The threats to the police actually came from down the street, but they were using, this house. I mean, that's happened a lot in cases of like child porn. This wasn't the first time this has happened, but somebody needs to remind the cops that an IP address is not necessarily associated with the activity inside that house. Pretty basic stuff, but, the cops aren't always on the bleeding edge of learning about these things, I guess.
I hate to keep bringing up this term as a pun, but it applies so well, Lauren, the name of your company, Blurry Edge. They're on the blurry edge because they're trying to do their best, and yet they're just not aware enough of how the technology functions to realize that they could be making a terrible mistake, such as what you just described, Evan. Lauren, are you concerned that all of this is sort of left to the discretion of the ISPs, whether they're going to decide to fork over this information or not? I mean, it's good that Comcast did what it did, but it's not a whole lot of certainty.
Yeah, it really is a issue where the intermediaries have so much control, and they, more and more, they have control. They have control in data that people are more likely to be storing in the cloud. They have control in, unique identifiers in phones or MAC addresses, speaking about mobile devices and, the Internet of Things. There's third parties that have this piece that can, link, actions back to people, not always accurately, as Evan points out, but they are the third parties, and it's good to have intermediaries. It's good to separate the name, the identity from some unique marker that's able to provide that's being used for some service, but. I think we should be looking towards a future where we put more obligations on companies to do like what Comcast did here. We should make sure that notice to users before information turned over is mandatory. We should look to the actions taken by Twitter earlier this year as models. And I find this so often with companies that I'm working with where they are doing some sort of work that requires a unique identifier, and they want to be good citizens and they want to be able to stand up when requests come for information. And it's very helpful when companies like Comcast do step up, because it provides, it in some ways does provide a role model for the littler companies. So I was really happy to see what's happening, and hopefully that's a model for moving forward.
Yep. We can only hope. All right, we're gonna move on to our tip of the week, which this week is how to clone Tetris. There's a decision, a court decision out of New Jersey, where the cloner of Tetris there, unfortunately, was, well, unfortunately for them, was held liable for copyright infringement because their version of they didn't call it Tetris, they called it Mino, but it's very close to the game of Tetris, and they were distributing their game in the iOS App Store. That they were sued, and they were found actually guilty of copyright infringement. But the opinion is instructive, as is this article at Ars Technica by Kyle Orland that we will put in our show notes, which you can get to after the show at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/168, our discussion points for the show. And it goes through how, yes, indeed, you can have games that are inspired by other games, and they will be just fine as long as they don't wholesale take over too many aspects of the original. The problem with this particular Tetris clone was that it used, you know, the exact dimensions of the playing field. There were just too many similarities between the two. Commentators here quoted in this article talk about how it would have been fairly easy to make a Tetris clone that would have been, you know, fine and playable and legally okay. You just have to be more careful than the folks were in this particular lawsuit. So if you're a developer and you have a game in mind that's inspired by another game, you know, take Words with Friends as your example and read this article and see if you can get together with your lawyers to be sure you navigate these waters correctly. And then our resource of the week is from Agence France Press, and it's called E-Diplomacy. And it is this great little tool. It's at ediplomacy.afp.com, and it's monitoring the Twitterverse to see countries and how they interact with each other. So the idea there is to, and this comes from, thank you, Franklin, our intern, for getting this information for us, the CEO, Emmanuel Hoog of Agence France-Presse. They are hoping that the tool may be commercialized by for professionals or media use via The Verge there. The website has developed its own algorithms, which seem to mimic creating a clout-esque kind of score. So it's going to tell you whether the particular country's use of Twitter is just kind of for promotional purposes or whether they actually communicate with each other and others, I assume. So, but the crux seems to be which world leaders are actually talking to each other, and that strikes me as an interesting thing to follow and track and potentially score. So thanks, Franklin, for finding e-diplomacy, and that is our resource for this week. We have had a lot of fun today, lots to cover. I really appreciate you guys joining us today for This Week in Law, both everyone in the audience and on the panel today, Larry Downs. Always great to have you on the show.
Love to be back anytime.
So you can also follow Larry. He's very engaging on Twitter. He would get a high clout-esque score were he a world power, and he's certainly on his way to becoming one. He is Larry Downs, just the full name spelled out with the E on the end of Downs. And so go find him there. And Larry, I was looking for you on Google+. Are you over there too?
You know, this is a longer story, but I've terminated my Google+ account.
Ah, well, maybe a story for another show. Just waiting for the glasses, perhaps, to be available. Then it will be really, really useful. Lauren, it was wonderful again to chat with you. Thanks so much for all your insights and input today.
Thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun having this wonderful conversation.
It was. And again, you can find Lauren. She's Lauren Gelman over on the Twitter. And once again, I couldn't find you on Google+ either. So maybe there's something going on here.
There's too many places to talk about things. So
yes, agree.
Yes. Understand. Which is a wonderful problem to have.
Mm-hmm. It is. Evan, of course, is internetcases.com and at internetcases on the Twitter. And it was great to be back. Thank you so much for minding the store last week while I was moseying about on horseback. That's mostly what I was doing while you were doing the show.
Well, that sounds fun. Yeah, I had a great time, doing the show. Like I said at the top, I don't know how you do it week in and week out. It takes a lot of brain cycles, and you do a great job. So I appreciate you letting me mind the store for a week, and it's good to be back this week. Really enjoyed the conversation as always with Larry and Lauren. So I always learn tons when I talk to the two of you. So thanks for letting me be here.
This is where I get my gray matter, you know. Otherwise, I'm just running around chauffeuring children and chasing different forms of lethal and non-lethal animal life around the planet. But
you two need to take it easier on yourselves. I saw there was some kind of report that came out this week to reconfirm. I mean, this is nothing new, that, you know, like losing your mind and as you get older. I was getting ready to say old age. I wasn't going to make that kind of thing. Losing your mind as you get older is so much of a myth. You know, it really is true that you can stay sharp mentally, and it's not a foregone conclusion that, you know, lack of mental capacity comes with advancing in years. So
yeah, anyway. We'll talk to you in 10 years, Evan, and see how you feel about that.
And I will have no recollection of all of this conversation. It'll
That's
be like,
true. Thank goodness there's, you know, documentary evidence. And it, once again, the right to forget probably has dire consequences for us as we move on in our lives.
By then, the French will have taken over our legal system, and everyone will have an inalienable right to be forgotten. So there we go.
Vive la France. Vive la MCLE. If you do need to or want to get that for listening to the show, we are attempting to help you out as much as possible. Go check out our wiki at wiki.twit.tv. Go to This Week in Law, and you'll find all the information you need there. And keep us posted on how that's going. You can get in touch with me and Evan. We are Denise at twit.tv and Evan at twit.tv. We'd love to hear from you about that or about things you want us to discuss. Everyone wanted to hear about the Posner opinion this week, so I'm glad we were able to unpack that a bit. And do check us out in all of the various places where you can find This Week in Law. Of course, we record Fridays at 11 o'clock Pacific, 1800 UTC at twit.tv. You can find us there at twit.tv/twill. You'll find the archive of all the shows we've ever done, 168 of them so far and counting. And of course, you can find us on iTunes and YouTube and all of the places that you look for this sort of programming. We're there. So we hope you will track us down in the way you most prefer. And we look forward to seeing you on the next episode of This Week in Law.